5 weeks in a balloon or journeys and discoveries in Africa by three Englishmen. Chapter 1. The end of a much applauded speech. The presentation of Dr. Samuel Ferguson. Excelsior. Full-length portrait of the doctor. A fatalist convinced. A dinner at the Travelers Club. Several toasts for the occasion. There was a large audience assembled on the 14th of January, 1862, at the session of the Royal Geographical Society, No. 3 Waterloo Place, London. The President, Sir Francis M., made an important communication to his colleagues, in an address that was frequently interrupted by applause. This rare specimen of eloquence terminated with the following sonorous phrases bubbling over with patriotism. England has always marched at the head of nations, for, the reader will observe, the nations always march at the head of each other, by the intrepidity of her explorers in the line of geographical discovery. General assent. Dr. Samuel Ferguson, one of her most glorious sons, will not reflect discredit on his origin. No, indeed. From all parts of the hall. This attempt, should it succeed, it will succeed, will complete and link together the notions, as yet disjointed, which the world entertains of African cartology, vehement applause, and, should it fail, it will, at least, remain on record as one of the most daring conceptions of human genius. Tremendous cheering. Huzzah! Huzzah! Shouted the immense audience, completely electrified by these inspiring words. Huzzah for the intrepid Ferguson! Cried one of the most excitable of the enthusiastic crowd. The wildest cheering resounded on all sides, the name of Ferguson was in every mouth, and we may safely believe that it lost nothing in passing through English throats. Indeed, the hall fairly shook with it. And there were present, also, those fearless travelers and explorers whose energetic temperaments had borne them through every quarter of the globe, many of them grown old and worn out in the service of science. All had, in some degree, physically or morally, undergone the sorest trials. They had escaped shipwreck, conflagration, Indian tomahawks and war clubs, the faggot and the stake, nay, even the cannibal maws of the South Sea Islanders. But still their hearts beat high during Sir Francis M.'s address, which certainly was the finest oratorical success that the Royal Geographical Society of London had yet achieved. But, in England, enthusiasm does not stop short with mere words. It strikes off money faster than the dies of the royal men itself. So a subscription to encourage Dr. Ferguson was voted there and then, and it at once attained the handsome amount of £2,500. The sum was made commensurate with the importance of the enterprise. A member of the society then inquired of the president whether Dr. Ferguson was not to be officially introduced. "The doctor is at the disposition of the meeting," replied Sir Francis. "Let him come in, then." "Bring him in," shouted the audience. "We'd like to see a man of such extraordinary daring, face to face." "Perhaps this incredible proposition of his is only intended to mystify us," growled an apoplectic old admiral. "Suppose that there should turn out to be no such person as Dr. Ferguson?" exclaimed another voice, with a malicious twang. "Why, then, we'd have to invent one," replied a facetious member of this grave society. "Ask Dr. Ferguson to come in," was the quiet remark of Sir Francis M. And come in the doctor did, and stood there, quite unmoved by the thunders of applause that greeted his appearance. He was a man of about 40 years of age, of medium height and physique. His sanguine temperament was disclosed in the deep color of his cheeks. His countenance was coldly expressive, with regular features, and a large nose, one of those noses that resemble the prow of a ship, and stamp the faces of men predestined to accomplish great discoveries. His eyes, which were gentle and intelligent, rather than bold, lent a peculiar charm to his physiognomy. His arms were long, and his feet were planted with that solidity which indicates a great pedestrian. A calm gravity seemed to surround the doctor's entire person, and no one would dream that he could become the agent of any mystification, however harmless. Hence, the applause that greeted him at the outset continued until he, with a friendly gesture, claimed silence on his own behalf. He stepped toward the seat that had been prepared for him on his presentation, and then, standing erect and motionless, he, with a determined glance, pointed his right forefinger upward, and pronounced aloud the single word. Excelsior! Never had one of Bright's or Cobden's sudden onslaughts, never had one of Palmerston's abrupt demands for funds to plate the rocks of the English coast with iron, made such a sensation. Sir Francis M.'s address was completely overshadowed. The doctor had shown himself moderate, sublime, and self-contained. In one, he had uttered the word of the situation. Excelsior! The gouty old admiral who had been finding fault, was completely won over by the singular man before him, and immediately moved the insertion of Dr. Ferguson's speech in the proceedings of the Royal Geographical Society of London. Who, then, was this person, and what was the enterprise that he proposed? Ferguson's father, a brave and worthy captain in the English Navy, had associated his son with him, from the young man's earliest years, in the perils and adventures of his profession. The fine little fellow, who seemed to have never known the meaning of fear, early revealed a keen and active mind, an investigating intelligence, and a remarkable turn for scientific study. Moreover, he disclosed uncommon address in extricating himself from difficulty. He was never perplexed, not even in handling his fork for the first time, an exercise in which children generally have so little success. His fancy kindled early at the recitals he read of daring enterprise and maritime adventure, and he followed with enthusiasm the discoveries that signalized the first part of the 19th century. He mused over the glory of the Mungo Parks, the Bruces, the Cayleys, the Levaillants, and to some extent, I verily believe, of Selkirk, Robinson Crusoe, whom he considered in no wise inferior to the rest. How many a well-employed hour he passed with that hero on his Isle of Juan Fernandez. Often he criticized the ideas of the shipwrecked sailor, and sometimes discussed his plans and projects. He would have done differently, in such and such a case, or quite as well at least, of that he felt assured. But of one thing he was satisfied, that he never should have left that pleasant island, where he was as happy as a king without subjects. No, not if the inducement held out had been promotion to the first lordship in the Admiralty. It may readily be conjectured whether these tendencies were developed during a youth of adventure, spent in every nook and corner of the globe. Moreover, his father, who was a man of thorough instruction, omitted no opportunity to consolidate this keen intelligence by serious studies in hydrography, physics, and mechanics, along with a slight tincture of botany, medicine, and astronomy. Upon the death of the estimable captain, Samuel Ferguson, then 22 years of age, had already made his voyage around the world. He had enlisted in the Bengalese Corps of Engineers, and distinguished himself in several affairs, but this soldier's life had not exactly suited him. Caring but little for command, he had not been fond of obeying. He, therefore, sent in his resignation, and half botanizing, half playing the hunter, he made his way toward the north of the Indian Peninsula, and crossed it from Calcutta to Surat, a mere amateur trip for him. From Surat we see him going over to Australia, and in 1845 participating in Captain Sturt's expedition, which had been sent out to explore the New Caspian Sea, supposed to exist in the center of New Holland. Samuel Ferguson returned to England about 1850, and, more than ever possessed by the demon of discovery, he spent the intervening time, until 1853, in accompanying Captain McClure on the expedition that went around the American continent from Bering Straits to Cape Farewell. Notwithstanding fatigues of every description, and in all climates, Ferguson's constitution continued marvelously sound. He felt at ease in the midst of the most complete privations. In fine, he was the very type of the thoroughly accomplished explorer whose stomach expands or contracts at will, whose limbs grow longer or shorter according to the resting place that each stage of a journey may bring, who can fall asleep at any hour of the day or awake at any hour of the night. Nothing, then, was less surprising, after that, than to find our traveler, in the period from 1855 to 1857, visiting the whole region west of the Tibet, in company with the brothers Slog and Waite, and bringing back some curious ethnographic observations from that expedition. During these different journeys, Ferguson had been the most active and interesting correspondent of the Daily Telegraph, the penny newspaper whose circulation amounts to 140,000 copies, and yet scarcely suffices for its many legions of readers. Thus, the doctor had become well known to the public, although he could not claim membership in either of the Royal Geographical Societies of London, Paris, Berlin, Vienna, or St. Petersburg, or yet with the Travelers Club, or even the Royal Polytechnic Institute, where his friend the statistician Coburn ruled in state. The latter savant had, one day, gone so far as to propose to him the following problem: given the number of miles traveled by the doctor in making the circuit of the globe, how many more had his head described than his feet, by reason of the different lengths of the radii? Or, the number of miles traversed by the doctor's head and feet respectively being given, required the exact height of that gentleman? This was done with the idea of complimenting him, but the doctor had held himself aloof from all the learned bodies belonging, as he did, to the church militant and not to the church polemical. He found his time better employed in seeking than in discussing, in discovering rather than discoursing. There is a story told of an Englishman who came one day to Geneva, intending to visit the lake. He was placed in one of those odd vehicles in which the passengers sit side by side, as they do in an omnibus. Well, it so happened that the Englishman got a seat that left him with his back turned toward the lake. The vehicle completed its circular trip without his thinking to turn around once, and he went back to London delighted with the Lake of Geneva. Dr. Ferguson, however, had turned around to look about him on his journeyings, and turned to such good purpose that he had seen a great deal. In doing so, he had simply obeyed the laws of his nature, and we have good reason to believe that he was, to some extent, a fatalist, but of an orthodox school of fatalism withal, that led him to rely upon himself and even upon Providence. He claimed that he was impelled, rather than drawn by his own volition, to journey as he did, and that he traversed the world like the locomotive, which does not direct itself, but is guided and directed by the track it runs on. "I do not follow my route," he often said, "it is my route that follows me." The reader will not be surprised, then, at the calmness with which the doctor received the applause that welcomed him in the Royal Society. He was above all such trifles, having no pride, and less vanity. He looked upon the proposition addressed to him by Sir Francis M. as the simplest thing in the world, and scarcely noticed the immense effect that it produced. When the session closed, the doctor was escorted to the rooms of the Travellers' Club, in Pall Mall. A superb entertainment had been prepared there in his honor. The dimensions of the dishes served were made to correspond with the importance of the personage entertained, and the boiled sturgeon that figured at this magnificent repast was not an inch shorter than Dr. Ferguson himself. Numerous toasts were offered and quaffed, in the wines of France, to the celebrated travelers who had made their names illustrious by their explorations of African territory. The guests drank to their health or to their memory, in alphabetical order, a good old English way of doing the thing. Among those remembered thus, were, Abadie, Adams, Adamson, Anderson, Arnault, Bakey, Baldwin, Barth, Batauda, Becca, Beltram, Duburba, Bimbachi, Bolognesi, Bullock, Belzoni, Bonamain, Brisson, Brown, Bruce, Brune Roland, Burchell, Burkhart, Burton, Kaland, Cayley, Campbell, Chapman, Clapperton, Clotbay, Colomu, Courval, Cumming, Cuny, De Bono, Deccan, Denham, Vissay Vanchers, Dixon, Dixon, Dockard, Duchayou, Duncan, Durand, Deruli, Duvayrier, Disquerac, Delacher, Erhard, Ferret, Fresnel, Gallinier, Galton, Geoffroy, Goldberry, Hahn, Hom, Harnier, Heckworth, Hoiglin, Horniman, Houghton, Imbert, Kaufmann, Knobletcher, Krapf, Kummer, Lafargue, Lying, Laffey, Lambert, Lemuriel, Lamprier, John Lander, Richard Lander, Lefebvre, Lejeune, Levalent, Livingstone, McCarthy, Magyar, Mason, Malzac, Moffat, Mollion, Montero, Morrison, Mungo Park, Niemans, Overweg, Panet, Partarl, Pascal, Pierce, Petty, Benny, Petherick, Ponce, Prax, Raffinel, Rab, Rubman, Richardson, Riley, Ritchie, Rochet Haricourt, Rongawi, Rosher, Ruppel, Sognier, Speak, Steidner, Thibault, Thompson, Thornton, Thule, Townsney, Trotter, Tucky, Tirrett, Vaudy, Vazier, Vincent, Vinco, Vogel, Wahlberg, Warrington, Washington, Verna, Wild, and last, but not least, Dr. Ferguson, who, by his incredible attempt, was to link together the achievements of all these explorers, and complete the series of African discovery. Chapter 2. The article in the Daily Telegraph. War between the scientific journals. Mr. Peterman backs his friend Dr. Ferguson. Reply of the savant Kuhner. Bets made. Sundry propositions offered to the doctor. On the next day, in its number of January 15, the Daily Telegraph published an article couched in the following terms. Africa is, at length, about to surrender the secret of her vast solitudes. A modern Oedipus is to give us the key to that enigma which the learned men of 60 centuries have not been able to decipher. In other days, to seek the sources of the Nile fontes nelliquorae was regarded as a mad endeavor, a chimera that could not be realized. Dr. Barth, in following out to Sudan the track traced by Denham and Clapperton, Dr. Livingstone, in multiplying his fearless explorations from the Cape of Good Hope to the basin of the Zambezi, Captains Burton and Speke, in the discovery of the great interior lakes, have opened three highways to modern civilization. Their point of intersection, which no traveler has yet been able to reach, is the very heart of Africa, and it is thither that all efforts should now be directed. The labors of these hardy pioneers of science are now about to be knit together by the daring project of Dr. Samuel Ferguson, whose fine explorations our readers have frequently had the opportunity of appreciating. This intrepid discoverer proposes to traverse all Africa from east to west in a balloon. If we are well informed, the point of departure for this surprising journey is to be the island of Zanzibar, upon the eastern coast. As for the point of arrival, it is reserved for Providence alone to designate. The proposal for this scientific undertaking was officially made, yesterday, at the rooms of the Royal Geographical Society, and the sum of £2,500 was voted to defray the expenses of the enterprise. We shall keep our readers informed as to the progress of this enterprise, which has no precedent in the annals of exploration. As may be supposed, the foregoing article had an enormous echo among scientific people. At first, it stirred up a storm of incredulity. Drive Ferguson passed for a purely chimerical personage of the Barnum stamp, who, after having gone through the United States, proposed to do the British Isles. A humorous reply appeared in the February number of the Bulletins de la Société Géographique of Geneva, which very wittily showed up the Royal Society of London and their phenomenal sturgeon. But Herr Petermann, in his Mittheilungen, published at Gotha, reduced the Geneva Journal to the most absolute silence. Herr Petermann knew Dr. Ferguson personally, and guaranteed the intrepidity of his dauntless friend. Besides, all manner of doubt was quickly put out of the question. Preparations for the trip were set on foot at London, the factories of Lyons received a heavy order for the silk required for the body of the balloon, and, finally, the British government placed the transport ship Resolute, Captain Bennett, at the disposal of the expedition. At once, upon word of all this, 1,000 encouragements were offered, and felicitations came pouring in from all quarters. The details of the undertaking were published in full in the Bulletins of the Geographical Society of Paris. A remarkable article appeared in the Nouvelle Annale des Voyages, de la Géographie, de l'Histoire, et de l'Archéologie de M.V.A. Malte Brun, New Annals of Travels, Geography, History, and Archaeology, by M.V.A. Malte Brun, and a searching essay in the Zeitschrift für Allgemeine Erdkunde, by Dr. W. Kuhner, triumphantly demonstrated the feasibility of the journey, its chances of success, the nature of the obstacles existing, the immense advantages of the aerial mode of locomotion, and found fault with nothing but the selected point of departure, which it contended should be Massowa, a small port in Abyssinia, whence James Bruce, in 1768, started upon his explorations in search of the sources of the Nile. Apart from that, it mentioned, in terms of unreserved admiration, the energetic character of Dr. Ferguson, and the heart, thrice panoplied in bronze, that could conceive and undertake such an enterprise. The North American Review could not, without some displeasure, contemplate so much glory monopolized by England. It therefore rather ridiculed the doctor's scheme, and urged him, by all means, to push his explorations as far as America, while he was about it. In a word, without going over all the journals in the world, there was not a scientific publication, from the Journal of Evangelical Missions to the Revue Algérienne et Coloniale, from the Annales de la Propagation de la Foi to the Church Missionary Intelligencer, that had not something to say about the affair in all its phases. Many large bets were made at London and throughout England generally, first, as to the real or supposititious existence of Dr. Ferguson, secondly, as to the trip itself, which, some contended, would not be undertaken at all, and which was really contemplated, according to others, thirdly, upon the success or failure of the enterprise, and fourthly, upon the probabilities of Dr. Ferguson's return. The betting books were covered with entries of immense sums, as though the Epsom races were at stake. Thus, believers and unbelievers, the learned and the ignorant, alike had their eyes fixed on the doctor, and he became the lion of the day, without knowing that he carried such a mane. On his part, he willingly gave the most accurate information touching his project. He was very easily approached, being naturally the most affable man in the world. More than one bold adventurer presented himself, offering to share the dangers as well as the glory of the undertaking, but he refused them all, without giving his reasons for rejecting them. Numerous inventors of mechanism applicable to the guidance of balloons came to propose their systems, but he would accept none, and, when he was asked whether he had discovered something of his own for that purpose, he constantly refused to give any explanation, and merely busied himself more actively than ever with the preparations for his journey. Chapter 3. The Doctor's Friend. The Origin of Their Friendship. Dick Kennedy at London. An unexpected but not very consoling proposal. A proverb by no means cheering. A few names from the African martyrology. The advantages of a balloon. Dr. Ferguson's secret. Dr. Ferguson had a friend, not another self, indeed, an alter ego, for friendship could not exist between two beings exactly alike. But, if they possessed different qualities, aptitudes, and temperaments, Dick Kennedy and Samuel Ferguson lived with one and the same heart, and that gave them no great trouble. In fact, quite the reverse. Dick Kennedy was a Scotchman, in the full acceptation of the word open, resolute, and headstrong. He lived in the town of Leith, which is near Edinburgh, and, in truth, is a mere suburb of Auldreekie. Sometimes he was a fisherman, but he was always and everywhere a determined hunter, and that was nothing remarkable for a son of Caledonia, who had known some little climbing among the Highland mountains. He was cited as a wonderful shot with a rifle, since not only could he split a bullet on a knife blade, but he could divide it into two such equal parts that, upon weighing them, scarcely any difference would be perceptible. Kennedy's countenance strikingly recalled that of Herbert Glendinning, as Sir Walter Scott has depicted it in the monastery. His stature was above 6 feet, full of grace and easy movement, he yet seemed gifted with Herculean strength, a face embrowned by the sun, eyes keen and black, a natural air of daring courage, in fine, something sound, solid, and reliable in his entire person, spoke, at first glance, in favor of the bonny Scot. The acquaintanceship of these two friends had been formed in India, when they belonged to the same regiment. While Dick would be out in pursuit of the tiger and the elephant, Samuel would be in search of plants and insects. Each could call himself expert in his own province, and more than one rare botanical specimen, that to science was as great a victory won as the conquest of a pair of ivory tusks, became the doctor's booty. These two young men, moreover, never had occasion to save each other's lives, or to render any reciprocal service. Hence, an unalterable friendship. Destiny sometimes bore them apart, but sympathy always united them again. Since their return to England they had been frequently separated by the doctor's distant expeditions, but, on his return, the latter never failed to go, not to ask for hospitality, but to bestow some weeks of his presence at the home of his crony Dick. The Scot talked of the past, the doctor busily prepared for the future. The one looked back, the other forward. Hence, a restless spirit personified in Ferguson, perfect calmness typified in Kennedy, such was the contrast. After his journey to the Tibet, the doctor had remained nearly 2 years without hinting at new explorations, and Dick, supposing that his friend's instinct for travel and thirst for adventure had at length died out, was perfectly enchanted. They would have ended badly, some day or other, he thought to himself, no matter what experience one has with men, one does not travel always with impunity among cannibals and wild beasts. So, Kennedy besought the doctor to tie up his bark for life, having done enough for science, and too much for the gratitude of men. The doctor contented himself with making no reply to this. He remained absorbed in his own reflections, giving himself up to secret calculations, passing his nights among heaps of figures, and making experiments with the strangest-looking machinery, inexplicable to everybody but himself. It could readily be guessed, though, that some great thought was fermenting in his brain. What can he have been planning? Wondered Kennedy, when, in the month of January, his friend quitted him to return to London. He found out one morning when he looked into the Daily Telegraph. Merciful heaven! He exclaimed, the lunatic. The madman. Cross Africa in a balloon. Nothing but that was wanted to cap the climax. That's what he's been bothering his wits about these 2 years past. Now, reader, substitute for all these exclamation points, as many ringing thumps with a brawny fist upon the table, and you have some idea of the manual exercise that Dick went through while he thus spoke. When his confidential maid of all work, the aged Elspeth, tried to insinuate that the whole thing might be a hoax. Not a bit of it, said he. Don't I know my man? Isn't it just like him? Travel through the air. There, now, he's jealous of the eagles, next. No. I warrant you, he'll not do it. I'll find a way to stop him. Why if they'd let him alone, he'd start some day for the moon. On that very evening Kennedy, half alarmed, and half exasperated, took the train for London, where he arrived next morning. 3/4 of an hour later a cab deposited him at the door of the doctor's modest dwelling, in Soho Square, Greek Street. Forthwith he bounded up the steps and announced his arrival with 5 good, hearty, sounding raps at the door. Ferguson opened, in person. Dick! You here? He exclaimed, but with no great expression of surprise, after all. Dick himself! Was the response. What, my dear boy, you at London, and this the mid-season of the winter shooting? Yes. Here I am, at London. And what have you come to town for? To prevent the greatest piece of folly that ever was conceived. Folly, said the doctor. Is what this paper says, the truth? Rejoined Kennedy, holding out the copy of the Daily Telegraph, mentioned above. Ah. That's what you mean, is it? These newspapers are great tattlers. But, sit down, my dear Dick. No, I won't sit down. Then, you really intend to attempt this journey? Most certainly. All my preparations are getting along finely, and I? Where are your traps? Let me have a chance at them. I'll make them fly. I'll put your preparations in fine order. And so saying, the gallant Scot gave way to a genuine explosion of wrath. Come, be calm, my dear Dick. Resumed the doctor. You're angry at me because I did not acquaint you with my new project. He calls this his new project. I have been very busy, the doctor went on, without heeding the interruption. I have had so much to look after. But rest assured that I should not have started without writing to you. Oh, indeed. I'm highly honored. Because it is my intention to take you with me. Upon this, the Scotchman gave a leap that a wild goat would not have been ashamed of among his native crags. Ah. Really, then, you want them to send us both to Bedlam? I have counted positively upon you, my dear Dick, and I have picked you out from all the rest. Kennedy stood speechless with amazement. After listening to me for 10 minutes, said the doctor, you will thank me. Are you speaking seriously? Very seriously. And suppose that I refuse to go with you? But you won't refuse. But, suppose that I were to refuse? Well, I'd go alone. Let us sit down, said Kennedy, and talk without excitement. The moment you give up jesting about it, we can discuss the thing. Let us discuss it, then, at breakfast, if you have no objections, my dear Dick. The two friends took their seats opposite to each other, at a little table with a plate of toast and a huge tea urn before them. My dear Samuel, said the sportsman, your project is insane. It is impossible. It has no resemblance to anything reasonable or practicable. That's for us to find out when we shall have tried it. But trying it is exactly what you ought not to attempt. Why so, if you please? Well, the risks, the difficulty of the thing. As for difficulties, replied Ferguson, in a serious tone, they were made to be overcome. As for risks and dangers, who can flatter himself that he is to escape them? Everything in life involves danger. It may even be dangerous to sit down at one's own table, or to put one's hat on one's own head. Moreover, we must look upon what is to occur as having already occurred, and see nothing but the present in the future, for the future is but the present a little farther on. There it is! Exclaimed Kennedy, with a shrug. As great a fatalist as ever. Yes. But in the good sense of the word. Let us not trouble ourselves, then, about what fate has in store for us, and let us not forget our good old English proverb, the man who was born to be hung will never be drowned. There was no reply to make, but that did not prevent Kennedy from resuming a series of arguments which may be readily conjectured, but which were too long for us to repeat. Well, then, he said, after an hour's discussion, if you are absolutely determined to make this trip across the African continent if it is necessary for your happiness, why not pursue the ordinary routes? Why? Ejaculated the doctor, growing animated. Because, all attempts to do so, up to this time, have utterly failed. Because, from Mungo Park, assassinated on the Niger, to Vogel, who disappeared in the Wadai country, from Oudney, who died at Murmur, and Clapperton, lost at Sakatu, to the Frenchman Mason, who was cut to pieces, from Major Lying, killed by the Tuaregs, to Roscher, from Hamburg, massacred in the beginning of 1860, the names of victim after victim have been inscribed on the lists of African martyrdom. Because, to contend successfully against the elements, against hunger, and thirst, and fever, against savage beasts, and still more savage men, is impossible. Because, what cannot be done in one way, should be tried in another. In fine, because what one cannot pass through directly in the middle, must be passed by going to one side or overhead. If passing over it were the only question, interposed Kennedy, but passing high up in the air, doctor, there's the rub. Come, then, said the doctor, what have I to fear? You will admit that I have taken my precautions in such manner as to be certain that my balloon will not fall, but, should it disappoint me, I should find myself on the ground in the normal conditions imposed upon other explorers. But, my balloon will not deceive me, and we need make no such calculations. Yes, but you must take them into view. No, Dick. I intend not to be separated from the balloon until I reach the western coast of Africa. With it, everything is possible, Without it, I fall back into the dangers and difficulties as well as the natural obstacles that ordinarily attend such an expedition. With it, neither heat, nor torrents, nor tempests, nor the simoom, nor unhealthy climates, nor wild animals, nor savage men, are to be feared. If I feel too hot, I can ascend, if too cold, I can come down. Should there be a mountain, I can pass over it, a precipice, I can sweep across it, a river, I can sail beyond it, a storm, I can rise away above it, a torrent, I can skim it like a bird. I can advance without fatigue, I can halt without need of repose. I can soar above the nascent cities. I can speed onward with the rapidity of a tornado, sometimes at the loftiest heights, sometimes only 100 feet above the soil, while the map of Africa unrolls itself beneath my gaze in the great atlas of the world. Even the stubborn Kennedy began to feel moved, and yet the spectacle thus conjured up before him gave him the vertigo. He riveted his eyes upon the doctor with wonder and admiration, and yet with fear, for he already felt himself swinging aloft in space. "Come, come," said he, at last. "Let us see, Samuel. Then you have discovered the means of guiding a balloon?" "Not by any means. That is a utopian idea." "Then, you will go whithersoever Providence wills, but, at all events, from east to west."
"Why so?"
"Because I expect to avail myself of the trade winds, the direction of which is always the same."
"Ah, yes, indeed," said Kennedy, reflecting, "the trade winds, yes, truly one might, there's something in that."
"Something in it, yes, my excellent friend, there's everything in it. The English government has placed a transport at my disposal, and 3 or 4 vessels are to cruise off the western coast of Africa, about the presumed period of my arrival. In 3 months, at most, I shall be at Zanzibar, where I will inflate my balloon, and from that point we shall launch ourselves."
"We," said Dick.
"Have you still a shadow of an objection to offer? Speak, friend Kennedy."
"An objection? I have 1,000, but among other things, tell me, if you expect to see the country, if you expect to mount and descend at pleasure, you cannot do so, without losing your gas. Up to this time no other means have been devised, and it is this that has always prevented long journeys in the air."
"My dear Dick, I have only one word to answer: I shall not lose one particle of gas."
"And yet you can descend when you please?"
"I shall descend when I please."
"And how will you do that?"
"Ah, ha! Therein lies my secret, friend Dick. Have faith, and let my device be yours, Excelsior."
"Excelsior be it then," said the sportsman, who did not understand a word of Latin. But he made up his mind to oppose his friend's departure by all means in his power, and so pretended to give in, at the same time keeping on the watch. As for the doctor, he went on diligently with his preparations.
Chapter 4. African Explorations. Barth, Richardson, Overweg, Verna, Brun Roland, Penny, Andrea, De Bono, Miani, Guillaumelgen, Bruce, Krapf, and Rubman, Mason, Rauscher, Burton, and Speke. The aerial line which Dr. Ferguson counted upon following had not been chosen at random. His point of departure had been carefully studied, and it was not without good cause that he had resolved to ascend at the island of Zanzibar. This island, lying nearer to the eastern coast of Africa, is in the 6th degree of south latitude, that is to say, 430 geographical miles below the equator. From this island the latest expedition, sent by way of the Great Lakes to explore the sources of the Nile, had just set out. But it would be well to indicate what explorations Dr. Ferguson hoped to link together. The two principal ones were those of Dr. Barth in 1849, and of Lieutenants Burton and Speke in 1858. Dr. Barth is a Hamburger, who obtained permission for himself and for his countryman Overweg to join the expedition of the Englishman Richardson. The latter was charged with a mission in the Sudan. This vast region is situated between the 15th and 10th degrees of north latitude, that is to say, that, in order to approach it, the explorer must penetrate 1,500 miles into the interior of Africa. Until then, the country in question had been known only through the journeys of Denham, of Clapperton, and of Oudney, made from 1822 to 1824. Richardson, Barth, and Overweg, jealously anxious to push their investigations farther, arrived at Tunis and Tripoli, like their predecessors, and got as far as Mort Souk, the capital of Fezzan. They then abandoned the perpendicular line, and made a sharp turn westward toward Ghent, guided, with difficulty, by the Tuaregs. After 1,000 scenes of pillage, of vexation, and attacks by armed forces, their caravan arrived, in October, at the vast oasis of Aspen. Dr. Barth separated from his companions,
made an excursion to the town of Agades, and rejoined the expedition, which resumed its march on the 12th of December. At length it reached the province of Damerghou. There the three travelers parted, and Barth took the road to Kano, where he arrived by dint of perseverance, and after paying considerable tribute. In spite of an intense fever, he quitted that place on the 7th of March, accompanied by a single servant. The principal aim of his journey was to reconnoitre Lake Chad, from which he was still 350 miles distant. He therefore advanced toward the east, and reached the town of Zurikolo, in the Bornu country, which is the core of the great central empire of Africa. There he heard of the death of Richardson, who had succumbed to fatigue and privation. He next arrived at Koka, the capital of Bornu, on the borders of the lake. Finally, at the end of 3 weeks, on the 14th of April, 12 months after having quitted Tripoli, he reached the town of Ngornu. We find him again setting forth on the 29th of March, 1851, with Overweg, to visit the kingdom of Adamawa, to the south of the lake, and from there he pushed on as far as the town of Yola, a little below 9 degrees north latitude. This was the extreme southern limit reached by that daring traveler. He returned in the month of August to Koka. From there he successively traversed the Mandara, Bargimi, and Clanum countries, and reached his extreme limit in the east, the town of Masenya, situated at 17 degrees 20 minutes west longitude. On the 25th of November, 1852, after the death of Overweg, his last companion, he plunged into the west, visited Sokoto, crossed the Niger, and finally reached Timbuktu, where he had to languish, during 8 long months, under vexations inflicted upon him by the sheik, and all kinds of ill-treatment and wretchedness. But the presence of a Christian in the city could not long be tolerated, and the Thoulans threatened to besiege it. The doctor, therefore, left it on the 17th of March, 1854, and fled to the frontier, where he remained for 33 days in the most abject destitution. He then managed to get back to Kano in November, thence to Koka, where he resumed Denham's route after 4 months' delay. He regained Tripoli toward the close of August, 1855, and arrived in London on the 6th of September, the only survivor of his party. Such was the venturesome journey of Dr. Barth. Dr. Ferguson carefully noted the fact that he had stopped at 4 degrees north latitude and 17 degrees west longitude. Now let us see what Lieutenants Burton and Speke accomplished in eastern Africa. The various expeditions that had ascended the Nile could never manage to reach the mysterious source of that river. According to the narrative of the German doctor, Ferdinand Werner, the expedition attempted in 1840, under the auspices of Mehemet Ali, stopped at Gondokoro, between the 4th and 5th parallels of north latitude. In 1855, Brun Roland, a native of Savoy, appointed consul for Sardinia in eastern Sudan, to take the place of Vadi, who had just died, set out from Khartoum, and, under the name of Yacoub the Merchant, trading in gums and ivory, got as far as Bilinia, beyond the 4th degree, but had to return in ill health to Khartoum, where he died in 1857. Neither Dr. Penny, the head of the Egyptian medical service, who, in a small steamer, penetrated 1 degree beyond Gondokoro, and then came back to die of exhaustion at Khartoum, nor Miani, the Venetian, who, turning the cataracts below Gondokoro, reached the second parallel, nor the Maltese trader, Andrea de Bono, who pushed his journey up the Nile still farther, could work their way beyond the apparently impassable limit. In 1859, M. Guillaume Ulgen, entrusted with a mission by the French government, reached Khartoum by way of the Red Sea, and embarked upon the Nile with a retinue of 21 hired men and 20 soldiers, but he could not get past Gondokoro, and ran extreme risk of his life among the Negro tribes, who were in full revolt. The expedition directed by M. Descayrac de Lacher made an equally unsuccessful attempt to reach the famous sources of the Nile. This fatal limit invariably brought every traveler to a halt. In ancient times, the ambassadors of Nero reached the 9th degree of latitude, but in 18 centuries only from 5 to 6 degrees, or from 300 to 360 geographical miles, were gained. Many travelers endeavored to reach the sources of the Nile by taking their point of departure on the eastern coast of Africa. Between 1768 and 1772 the Scotch traveler, Bruce, set out from Massowa, a port of Abyssinia, traversed the Tigra, visited the ruins of Axum, saw the sources of the Nile where they did not exist, and obtained no serious result. In 1844, Dr. Krapf, an Anglican missionary, founded an establishment at Monbiz, on the coast of Zanzibar, and, in company with the Reverend Drive Rebman, discovered two mountain ranges 300 miles from the coast. These were the mountains of Kilimanjaro and Kenya, which Messrs. De Heuglin and Thornton have partly scaled so recently. In 1845, Mason, the French explorer, disembarked, alone, at Bagamoyo, directly opposite to Zanzibar, and got as far as Dahel Amhora, where the chief caused him to be put to death in the most cruel torment. In 1859, in the month of August, the young traveller, Roscher, from Hamburg, set out with a caravan of Arab merchants, reached Lake Nyasa, and was there assassinated while he slept. Finally, in 1857, Lieutenants Burton and Speke, both officers in the Bengal Army, were sent by the London Geographical Society to explore the Great African Lakes, and on the 17th of June they quitted Zanzibar, and plunged directly into the West. After 4 months of incredible suffering, their baggage having been pillaged, and their attendants beaten and slain, they arrived at Kazeh, a sort of central rendezvous for traders and caravans. They were in the midst of the country of the moon, and there they collected some precious documents concerning the manners, government, religion, fauna, and flora of the region. They next made for the first of the Great Lakes, the one named Tanganyika, situated between the 3rd and 8th degrees of south latitude. They reached it on the 14th of February, 1858, and visited the various tribes residing on its banks, the most of whom are cannibals. They departed again on the 26th of May, and re-entered Kazeh on the 20th of June. There Burton, who was completely worn out, lay ill for several months, during which time Speke made a push to the northward of more than 300 miles, going as far as Lake Okarakua, which he came in sight of on the 3rd of August, but he could descry only the opening of it at latitude 2 degrees 30 minutes. He reached Kazeh, on his return, on the 25th of August, and, in company with Burton, again took up the route to Zanzibar, where they arrived in the month of March in the following year. These two daring explorers then re-embarked for England, and the Geographical Society of Paris decreed them its annual prize medal. Dr. Ferguson carefully remarked that they had not gone beyond the 2nd degree of south latitude, nor the 29th of east longitude. The problem, therefore, was how to link the explorations of Burton and Speke with those of Dr. Barth, since to do so was to undertake to traverse an extent of more than 12 degrees of territory. Chapter 5. Kennedy's dreams. Articles and pronouns in the plural. Dick's insinuations. A promenade over the map of Africa. What is contained between two points of the compass? Expeditions now on foot. Speke and Grant. Krapf, de Decken, and de Heuglin. Dr. Ferguson energetically pushed the preparations for his departure, and in person superintended the construction of his balloon, with certain modifications, in regard to which he observed the most absolute silence. For a long time past he had been applying himself to the study of the Arab language and the various Mandingo idioms, and, thanks to his talents as a polyglot, he had made rapid progress. In the meanwhile his friend, the sportsman, never let him out of his sight afraid, no doubt, that the doctor might take his departure, without saying a word to anybody. On this subject, he regaled him with the most persuasive arguments, which, however, did not persuade Samuel Ferguson, and wasted his breath in pathetic entreaties, by which the latter seemed to be but slightly moved. In fine, Dick felt that the doctor was slipping through his fingers. The poor Scot was really to be pitied. He could not look upon the azure vault without a somber terror. When asleep, he felt oscillations that made his head reel, and every night he had visions of being swung aloft at immeasurable heights. We must add that, during these fearful nightmares, he once or twice fell out of bed. His first care then was to show Ferguson a severe contusion that he had received on the cranium. And yet, he would add, with warmth, that was at the height of only 3 feet not an inch more and such a bump as this. Only think, then. This insinuation, full of sad meaning as it was, did not seem to touch the doctor's heart. "Will not fall," was his invariable reply. "But, still, suppose that we were to fall." "We will not fall." This was decisive, and Kennedy had nothing more to say. What particularly exasperated Dick was, that the doctor seemed completely to lose sight of his personality of his Kennedys and to look upon him as irrevocably destined to become his aerial companion. Not even the shadow of a doubt was ever suggested, and Samuel made an intolerable misuse of the first person plural. "We are getting along, we shall be ready on the, we shall start on the, etc., etc." And then there was the singular possessive adjective. "Our balloon, our car, our expedition." And the same in the plural, too. "Our preparations, our discoveries, our ascensions." Dick shuddered at them, although he was determined not to go, but he did not want to annoy his friend. Let us also disclose the fact that, without knowing exactly why himself, he had sent to Edinburgh for a certain selection of heavy clothing, and his best hunting gear and firearms. One day, after having admitted that, With an overwhelming run of good luck, there might be one chance of success in 1,000, he pretended to yield entirely to the doctor's wishes, but, in order to still put off the journey, he opened the most varied series of subterfuges. He threw himself back upon questioning the utility of the expedition, its opportuneness, etc. This discovery of the sources of the Nile, was it likely to be of any use? Would one have really labored for the welfare of humanity? When, after all, the African tribes should have been civilized, would they be any happier? Were folks certain that civilization had not its chosen abode there rather than in Europe? Perhaps. And then, couldn't one wait a little longer? The trip across Africa would certainly be accomplished someday, and in a less hazardous manner. In another month, or in 6 months before the year was over, some explorer would undoubtedly come in, etc., etc. These hints produced an effect exactly opposite to what was desired or intended, and the doctor trembled with impatience. Are you willing, then, wretched Dick, are you willing, false friend, that this glory should belong to another? Must I then be untrue to my past history, recoil before obstacles that are not serious, requite with cowardly hesitation what both the English government and the Royal Society of London have done for me? But, resumed Kennedy, who made great use of that conjunction. But, said the doctor, are you not aware that my journey is to compete with the success of the expeditions now on foot? Don't you know that fresh explorers are advancing toward the center of Africa? Still. Listen to me, Dick, and cast your eyes over that map. Dick glanced over it, with resignation. Now, ascend the course of the Nile. I have ascended it, replied the Scotchman, with docility. Stop at Gondokoro. I am there. And Kennedy thought to himself how easy such a trip was on the map. Now, take one of the points of these dividers and let it rest upon that place beyond which the most daring explorers have scarcely gone. I have done so. And now look along the coast for the island of Zanzibar, in latitude 6 degrees south. I have it. Now, follow the same parallel and arrive at Kazeh. I have done so. Run up again along the 33rd degree of longitude to the opening of Lake Ukere, at the point where Lieutenant Speke had to halt. I am there, a little more, and I should have tumbled into the lake. Very good. Now, do you know what we have the right to suppose, according to the information given by the tribes that live along its shores? I haven't the least idea. Why, that this lake, the lower extremity of which is in 2 degrees and 30 minutes, must extend also 2 degrees and a half above the equator. Really? Well, from this northern extremity there flows a stream which must necessarily join the Nile, if it be not the Nile itself. That is, indeed, curious. Then, let the other point of your dividers rest upon that extremity of Lake Ukere. It is done, friend Ferguson. Now, how many degrees can you count between the two points? Scarcely 2. And do you know what that means, Dick? Not the least in the world. Why, that makes scarcely 120 miles, in other words, a nothing. Almost nothing, Samuel. Well, do you know what is taking place at this moment? No, upon my honor, I do not. Very well, then, I'll tell you. The Geographical Society regard as very important the exploration of this lake of which Speke caught a glimpse. Under their auspices, Lieutenant, now Captain, Speke has associated with him Captain Grant, of the Army in India. They have put themselves at the head of a numerous and well-equipped expedition. Their mission is to ascend the lake and return to Gondokoro. They have received a subsidy of more than £5,000, and the Governor of the Cape of Good Hope has placed Hottentot soldiers at their disposal. They set out from Zanzibar at the close of October, 1860. In the meanwhile, John Petherick, the English consul at the city of Khartoum, has received about £700 from the Foreign Office. He is to equip a steamer at Khartoum, stock it with sufficient provisions, and make his way to Gondokoro. There, he will await Captain Speke's caravan, and be able to replenish its supplies to some extent. Well planned, said Kennedy. You can easily see, then, that time presses if we are to take part in these exploring labors. And that is not all, since, while some are thus advancing with sure steps to the discovery of the sources of the Nile, others are penetrating to the very heart of Africa. On foot? Said Kennedy. Yes, on foot, rejoined the doctor, without noticing the insinuation. Dr. Krapf proposes to push forward, in the west, by way of the Job, a river lying under the equator. Baron de Decken has already set out from Monbiz, has reconnoitered the mountains of Kenai and Kilimanjaro, and is now plunging in toward the center. But all this time on foot? On foot or on mules? Exactly the same, so far as I am concerned, ejaculated Kennedy. Leslie, resumed the doctor, M. de Heuglin, the Austrian vice consul at Khartoum, has just organized a very important expedition, the first aim of which is to search for the traveler Vogel, who, in 1853, was sent into the Sudan to associate himself with the labors of Dr. Barth. In 1856, he quitted Bornu, and determined to explore the unknown country that lies between Lake Chad and Darfur. Nothing has been seen of him since that time. Letters that were received in Alexandria, in 1860, said that he was killed at the order of the King of Wadi, but other letters, addressed by Dr. Hartmann to the traveler's father, relate that, according to the recital of a falata of Bornu, Vogel was merely held as a prisoner in Mara. All hope is not then lost. Hence, a committee has been organized under the presidency of the regent of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, my friend Petermann is its secretary, a national subscription has provided for the expense of the expedition, whose strength has been increased by the voluntary accession of several learned men, and M. de Heuglin set out from Massowa, in the month of June. While engaged in looking for Vogel, he is also to explore all the country between the Nile and Lake Chad, that is to say, to knit together the operations of Captain Speke and those of Dr. Barth, and then Africa will have been traversed from east to west. After the departure of Dr. Ferguson, it was ascertained that M. de Heuglin, owing to some disagreement, took a route different from the one assigned to his expedition, the command of the latter having been transferred to Mr. Munsinger. "Well," said the canny Scot, "since everything is getting on so well, what's the use of our going down there?" Dr. Ferguson made no reply, but contented himself with a significant shrug of the shoulders. Chapter 6. A servant match him. He can see the satellites of Jupiter. Dick and Joe hard at it. Doubt and faith. The weighing ceremony. Joe and Wellington. He gets a half crown. Dr. Ferguson had a servant who answered with alacrity to the name of Joe. He was an excellent fellow, who testified the most absolute confidence in his master, and the most unlimited devotion to his interests, even anticipating his wishes and orders, which were always intelligently executed. In fine, he was a Caleb without the growling, and a perfect pattern of constant good humor. Had he been made on purpose for the place, it could not have been better done. Ferguson put himself entirely in his hands, so far as the ordinary details of existence were concerned, and he did well. Incomparable, whole-souled Joe. A servant who orders your dinner, who likes what you like, who packs your trunk, without forgetting your socks or your linen, who is charge of your keys and your secrets, and takes no advantage of all this. But then, what a man the doctor was in the eyes of this worthy Joe. With what respect and what confidence the latter received all his decisions. When Ferguson had spoken, he would be a fool who should attempt to question the matter. Everything he thought was exactly right, everything he said, the perfection of wisdom, everything he ordered to be done, quite feasible, all that he undertook, practicable, all that he accomplished, admirable. You might have cut Joe to pieces, not an agreeable operation, to be sure, and yet he would not have altered his opinion of his master. So, when the doctor conceived the project of crossing Africa through the air, for Joe the thing was already done, obstacles no longer existed. From the moment when the doctor had made up his mind to start, he had arrived along with his faithful attendant, too, for the noble fellow knew, without a word uttered about it, that he would be one of the party. Moreover, he was just the man to render the greatest service by his intelligence and his wonderful agility. Had the occasion arisen to name a professor of gymnastics for the monkeys in the zoological garden, who are smart enough, by the way, Joe would certainly have received the appointment. Leaping, climbing, almost flying, these were all sport to him. If Ferguson was the head and Kennedy the arm, Joe was to be the right hand of the expedition. He had, already, accompanied his master on several journeys, and had a smattering of science appropriate to his condition and style of mind, but he was especially remarkable for a sort of mild philosophy, a charming turn of optimism. In his sight everything was easy, logical, natural, and, consequently, he could see no use in complaining or grumbling. Among other gifts, he possessed a strength and range of vision that were perfectly surprising. He enjoyed, in common with Moestlin, Kepler's professor, the rare faculty of distinguishing the satellites of Jupiter with the naked eye, and of counting 14 of the stars in the group of Pleiades, the remotest of them being only of the 9th magnitude. He presumed none the more for that; on the contrary, he made his bow to you, at a distance, and when occasion arose he bravely knew how to use his eyes. With such profound faith as Joe felt in the doctor, it is not to be wondered at that incessant discussions sprang up between him and Kennedy, without any lack of respect to the latter, however. One doubted, the other believed; one had a prudent foresight, the other blind confidence. The doctor, however, vibrated between doubt and confidence, that is to say, he troubled his head with neither one nor the other. "Well, Mr. Kennedy," Joe would say. "Well, my boy? The moment's at hand. It seems that we are to sail for the moon." "You mean the mountains of the moon, which are not quite so far off. But, never mind, one trip is just as dangerous as the other."
"Dangerous? What? With a man like Dr. Ferguson?"
"I don't want to spoil your illusions, my good Joe, but this undertaking of his is nothing more nor less than the act of a madman.
He won't go, though."
"He won't go, eh? Then you haven't seen his balloon at Mitchell's factory in the borough?"
"I'll take precious good care to keep away from it."
"Well, you'll lose a fine sight, sir. What a splendid thing it is. What a pretty shape. What a nice car. How snug we'll feel in it."
"Then you really think of going with your master?"
"I?" answered Joe, with an accent of profound conviction. "Why, I'd go with him wherever he pleases. Whoever heard of such a thing? Leave him to go off alone, after we've been all over the world together. Who would help him, when he was tired? Who would give him a hand in climbing over the rocks? Who would attend him when he was sick? No, Mr. Kennedy, Joe will always stick to the doctor.
You're a fine fellow, Joe.
But, then, you're coming with us."
"Oh, certainly," said Kennedy, "that is to say, I will go with you up to the last moment, to prevent Samuel even then from being guilty of such an act of folly. I will follow him as far as Zanzibar, so as to stop him there, if possible."
"You'll stop nothing at all, Mr. Kennedy, with all respect to you, sir. My master is no harebrained person, he takes a long time to think over what he means to do, and then, when he once gets started, the evil one himself couldn't make him give it up."
"Well, we'll see about that.
Don't flatter yourself, sir, but then, the main thing is, to have you with us. For a hunter like you, sir, Africa's a great country. So, either way, you won't be sorry for the trip."
"No, that's a fact, I shan't be sorry for it, if I can get this crazy man to give up his scheme."
"By the way," said Joe, "you know that the weighing comes off today."
"The weighing? What weighing?"
"Why, my master, and you, and I, are all to be weighed today."
"What? Like horse jockeys?"
"Yes, like jockeys. Only, never fear, you won't be expected to make yourself lean, if you're found to be heavy. You'll go as you are."
"Well, I can tell you, I am not going to let myself be weighed," said Kennedy, firmly.
"But, sir, it seems that the doctor's machine requires it."
"Well, his machine will have to do without it."
"Humphrey.
And suppose that it couldn't go up, then?"
"Egad. That's all I want."
"Come. Come, Mr. Kennedy. My master will be sending for us directly."
"I shan't go."
"Oh. Now, you won't vex the doctor in that way."
"I. That I will."
"Well," said Joe with a laugh, "you say that because he's not here, but when he says to your face, 'Dick. With all respect to you, sir, Dick, I want to know exactly how much you weigh,' you'll go, I warrant it."
"No, I will not go."
At this moment the doctor entered his study, where this discussion had been taking place, and, as he came in, cast a glance at Kennedy, who did not feel altogether at his ease.
"Dick," said the doctor, "come with Joe, I want to know how much you both weigh."
"But..."
"You may keep your hat on. Come." And Kennedy went. They repaired in company to the workshop of the Messrs. Mitchell, where one of those so-called Roman scales was in readiness. It was necessary, by the way, for the doctor to know the weight of his companions, so as to fix the equilibrium of his balloon, so he made Dick get up on the platform of the scales. The latter, without making any resistance, said, in an undertone,
"Oh. Well, that doesn't bind me to anything."
153 pounds, said the doctor, noting it down on his tablets.
"Am I too heavy?"
"Why, no, Mr. Kennedy," said Joe, "and then, you know, I am light to make up for it." So saying, Joe, with enthusiasm, took his place on the scales, and very nearly upset them in his ready haste. He struck the attitude of Wellington where he is made to ape Achilles, at Hyde Park entrance, and was superb in it, without the shield.
120 pounds, wrote the doctor.
"Ah! Ha!" said Joe, with a smile of satisfaction, and why did he smile? He never could tell himself.
"It's my turn now," said Ferguson, and he put down 135 pounds to his own account.
"All three of us," said he, "do not weigh much more than 400 pounds.
But, sir, said Joe, if it was necessary for your expedition, I could make myself thinner by 20 pounds, by not eating so much.
Useless, my boy, replied the doctor. You may eat as much as you like, and here's half a crown to buy you the ballast.
Chapter 7. Geometrical details. Calculation of the capacity of the balloon. The double receptacle. The covering. The car. The mysterious apparatus. The provisions and stores. The final summing up.
Dr. Ferguson had long been engaged upon the details of his expedition. It is easy to comprehend that the balloon, that marvelous vehicle which was to convey him through the air, was the constant object of his solicitude. At the outset, in order not to give the balloon too ponderous dimensions, he had decided to fill it with hydrogen gas, which is 14.5 times lighter than common air. The production of this gas is easy, and it has given the greatest satisfaction hitherto in aerostatic experiments. The doctor, according to very accurate calculations, found that, including the articles indispensable to his journey and his apparatus, he should have to carry a weight of 4,000 pounds, therefore he had to find out what would be the ascensional force of a balloon capable of raising such a weight, and, consequently, what would be its capacity. A weight of 4,000 pounds is represented by a displacement of the air amounting to 44,847 cubic feet, or, in other words, 44,847 cubic feet of air weigh about 4,000 pounds. By giving the balloon these cubic dimensions, and filling it with hydrogen gas, instead of common air, the former being 14.5 times lighter and weighing therefore only 276 pounds, a difference of 3,724 pounds in equilibrium is produced, and it is this difference between the weight of the gas contained in the balloon and the weight of the surrounding atmosphere that constitutes the ascensional force of the former. However, with the 44,847 cubic feet of gas of which we speak, all introduced into the balloon, it would be entirely filled, but that would not do, because, as the balloon continued to mount into the more rarefied layers of the atmosphere, the gas within would dilate, and soon burst the cover containing it. Balloons, then, are usually only two-thirds filled. But the doctor, in carrying out a project known only to himself, resolved to fill his balloon only one-half, and, since he had to carry 44,847 cubic feet of gas, to give his balloon nearly double capacity, he arranged it in that elongated, oval shape which has come to be preferred. The horizontal diameter was 50 feet, and the vertical diameter 75 feet. He thus obtained a spheroid, the capacity of which amounted, in round numbers, to 90,000 cubic feet. Could Dr. Ferguson have used two balloons, his chances of success would have been increased, for, should one burst in the air, he could, by throwing out ballast, keep himself up with the other. But the management of two balloons would, necessarily, be very difficult, in view of the problem how to keep them both at an equal ascensional force. After having pondered the matter carefully, Dr. Ferguson, by an ingenious arrangement, combined the advantages of two balloons, without incurring their inconveniences. He constructed two of different sizes, and enclosed the smaller in the larger one. His external balloon, which had the dimensions given above, contained a less one of the same shape, which was only 45 feet in horizontal, and 68 feet in vertical diameter. The capacity of this interior balloon was only 67,000 cubic feet. It was to float in the fluid surrounding it. A valve opened from one balloon into the other, and thus enabled the air not to communicate with both. This arrangement offered the advantage, that if gas had to be let off, so as to descend, that which was in the outer balloon would go first, and, were it completely emptied, the smaller one would still remain intact. The outer envelope might then be cast off as a useless encumbrance, and the second balloon, left free to itself, would not offer the same hold to the currents of air as a half-inflated one must needs present. Moreover, in case of an accident happening to the outside balloon, such as getting torn, for instance, the other would remain intact. The balloons were made of a strong but light lion's silk, coated with gutta percha. This gummy, resinous substance is absolutely waterproof, and also resists acids and gas perfectly. The silk was doubled, at the upper extremity of the oval, where most of the strain would come. Such an envelope as this could retain the inflating fluid for any length of time. It weighed half a pound per 9 square feet. Hence the surface of the outside balloon being about 11,600 square feet, its envelope weighed 650 pounds. The envelope of the second or inner balloon, having 9,200 square feet of surface, weighed only about 510 pounds, or say 1,160 pounds for both. The network that supported the car was made of very strong hempen cord,
and the two valves were the object of the most minute and careful attention, as the rudder of a ship would be. The car, which was of a circular form and 15 feet in diameter, was made of wickerwork, strengthened with a slight covering of iron, and protected below by a system of elastic springs, to deaden the shock of collision. Its weight, along with that of the network, did not exceed 250 pounds. In addition to the above, the doctor caused to be constructed two sheet iron chests 2 lines in thickness. These were connected by means of pipes furnished with stopcocks. He joined to these a spiral, 2 inches in diameter, which terminated in 2 branch pieces of unequal length, the longer of which, however, was 25 feet in height and the shorter only 15 feet. These sheet iron chests were embedded in the car in such a way as to take up the least possible amount of space. The spiral, which was not to be adjusted until some future moment, was packed up, separately, along with a very strong Bunsen electric battery. This apparatus had been so ingeniously combined that it did not weigh more than 700 pounds, even including 25 gallons of water in another receptacle. The instruments provided for the journey consisted of 2 barometers, 2 thermometers, 2 compasses, a sextant, 2 chronometers, an artificial horizon, and an altazimuth, to throw out the height of distant and inaccessible objects. The Greenwich Observatory had placed itself at the doctor's disposal. The latter, however, did not intend to make experiments in physics, he merely wanted to be able to know in what direction he was passing, and to determine the position of the principal rivers, mountains, and towns. He also provided himself with 3 thoroughly tested iron anchors, and a light but strong silk ladder 50 feet in length. He at the same time carefully weighed his stores of provision, which consisted of tea, coffee, biscuit, salted meat, and pemmican, a preparation which comprises many nutritive elements in a small space. Besides a sufficient stock of pure brandy, he arranged 2 water tanks, each of which contained 22 gallons. The consumption of these articles would necessarily, little by little, diminish the weight to be sustained, for it must be remembered that the equilibrium of a balloon floating in the atmosphere is extremely sensitive. The loss of an almost insignificant weight suffices to produce a very noticeable displacement. Nor did the doctor forget an awning to shelter the car, nor the coverings and blankets that were to be the bedding of the journey, nor some fowling pieces and rifles, with their requisite supply of powder and ball. Here is the summing up of his various items, and their weight, as he computed it. Ferguson. 135 pounds. Kennedy. 153 Joe. 120 weight of the outside balloon. 650 weight of the second balloon. 510 car and network. 280 anchors, instruments, awnings, and sundry utensils, guns, coverings, etc. 190 meat, pemmican, biscuits, tea, coffee, brandy. 386 water. 400 apparatus. 700 weight of the hydrogen. 276 ballast. 200-4,000 pounds. Such were the items of the 4,000 pounds that Dr. Ferguson proposed to carry up with him. He took only 200 pounds of ballast for unforeseen emergencies, as he remarked, since otherwise he did not expect to use any, thanks to the peculiarity of his apparatus. Chapter 8. Joe's importance. The commander of the Resolute. Kennedy's arsenal. Mutual amenities. The farewell dinner. Departure on the 21st of February. The doctor's scientific sessions. Duverrier. Livingstone. Details of the aerial voyage. Kennedy silenced. About the 10th of February, the preparations were pretty well completed, and the balloons, firmly secured, one within the other, were altogether finished. They had been subjected to a powerful pneumatic pressure in all parts, and the test gave excellent evidence of their solidity and of the care applied in their construction. Joe hardly knew what he was about, with delight. He trotted incessantly to and fro between his home in Greek Street, and the Mitchell establishment, always full of business, but always in the highest spirits, giving details of the affair to people who did not even ask him, so proud was he, above all things, of being permitted to accompany his master. I have even a shrewd suspicion that what with showing the balloon, explaining the plans and views of the doctor, giving folks a glimpse of the latter, through a half-opened window, or pointing him out as he passed along the streets, the clever scamp earned a few half-crowns, but we must not find fault with him for that. He had as much right as anybody else to speculate upon the admiration and curiosity of his contemporaries. On the 16th of February, the Resolute cast anchor near Greenwich. She was a screw propeller of 800 tons, a fast sailer, and the very vessel that had been sent out to the polar regions, to revictual the last expedition of Sir James Ross. Her commander, Captain Bennett, had the name of being a very amiable person, and he took a particular interest in the doctor's expedition, having been one of the gentleman's admirers for a long time. Bennett was rather a man of science than a man of war, which did not, however, prevent his vessel from carrying 4 carronades, that had never hurt anybody, to be sure, but had performed the most pacific duty in the world. The hold of the Resolute was so arranged as to find a stowing place for the balloon. The latter was shipped with the greatest precaution on the 18th of February, and was then carefully deposited at the bottom of the vessel in such a way as to prevent accident. The car and its accessories, the anchors, the cords, the supplies, the water tanks, which were to be filled on arriving, all were embarked and put away under Ferguson's own eyes. 10 tons of sulfuric acid and 10 tons of iron filings were put on board for the future production of the hydrogen gas. The quantity was more than enough, but it was well to be provided against accident. The apparatus to be employed in manufacturing the gas, including some 30 empty casks, was also stowed away in the hold. These various preparations were terminated on the 18th of February, in the evening. 2 staterooms, comfortably fitted up, were ready for the reception of Dr. Ferguson and his friend Kennedy. The latter, all the while swearing that he would not go, went on board with a regular arsenal of hunting weapons, among which were 2 double-barreled breech-loading fowling pieces, and a rifle that had withstood every test, of the make of Purdy, Moore, and Dixon, at Edinburgh. With such a weapon a marksman would find no difficulty in lodging a bullet in the eye of a chamois at the distance of 2,000 paces. Along with these implements, he had 2 of Colt's 6-shooters, for unforeseen emergencies. His powder case, his cartridge pouch, his lead, and his bullets, did not exceed a certain weight prescribed by the doctor. The 3 travelers got themselves to rights on board during the working hours of February 19. They were received with much distinction by the captain and his officers, the doctor continuing as reserved as ever, and thinking of nothing but his expedition. Dick seemed a good deal moved, but was unwilling to betray it, while Joe was fairly dancing and breaking out in laughable remarks. The worthy fellow soon became the jester and merry andrew of the bosun's mess, where a berth had been kept for him. On the 20th, a grand farewell dinner was given to Dr. Ferguson and Kennedy by the Royal Geographical Society. Commander Bennett and his officers were present at the entertainment, which was signalized by copious libations and numerous toasts. Healths were drunk, in sufficient abundance to guarantee all the guests a lifetime of centuries. Sir Francis M. presided, with restrained but dignified feeling. To his own supreme confusion, Dick Kennedy came in for a large share in the jovial felicitations of the night. After having drunk to the intrepid Ferguson, the glory of England, they had to drink to the no less courageous Kennedy, his daring companion. Dick blushed a good deal, and that passed for modesty, whereupon the applause redoubled, and Dick blushed again. A message from the Queen arrived while they were at dessert. Her Majesty offered her compliments to the 2 travelers, and expressed her wishes for their safe and successful journey. This, of course, rendered imperative fresh toasts to her most gracious Majesty. At midnight, after touching farewells and warm shaking of hands, the guests separated. The boats of the Resolute were in waiting at the stairs of Westminster Bridge. The captain leapt in, accompanied by his officers and passengers, and the rapid current of the Thames, aiding the strong arms of the rowers, bore them swiftly to Greenwich. In an hour's time all were asleep on board. The next morning, February 21, at 3 o'clock, the furnaces began to roar, at 5, the anchors were weighed, and the Resolute, powerfully driven by her screw, began to plow the water toward the mouth of the Thames. It is needless to say that the topic of conversation with everyone on board was Dr. Ferguson's enterprise. Seeing and hearing the doctor soon inspired everybody with such confidence that, in a very short time, there was no one, excepting the incredulous Scotchman, on the steamer who had the least doubt of the perfect feasibility and success of the expedition. During the long, unoccupied hours of the voyage, the doctor held regular sittings, with lectures on geographical science, in the officers' mess room. These young men felt an intense interest in the discoveries made during the last 40 years in Africa, and the doctor related to them the explorations of Barth, Burton, Speke, and Grant, and depicted the wonders of this vast, mysterious country, now thrown open on all sides to the investigations of science. On the north, the young Duveyrier was exploring Sahara, and bringing the chiefs of the Tuaregs to Paris. Under the inspiration of the French government, 2 expeditions were preparing, which, descending from the north, and coming from the west, would cross each other at Timbuktu. In the south, the indefatigable Livingstone was still